I'm going to get started, and we'll just start with the unimportant stuff so that as people drift in, it doesn't make a difference. I apologize for using Windows to give this presentation, but like Miguel, I don't care. I'm sort of a nonpartisan. I love Linux. I love developing in Linux, but I'm a huge game player, so I am used to screwing with Windows. And I, though I work at Transmeta and ought to wave the flag, I hate portable computers. So I don't own one, and I use the one that they had dissected to analyze earlier. So it happened to be running Windows. But anyway, my talk is about optimizing for portable computers and portable devices. It's coincidentally about Crusoe optimization, but a lot of the optimization tips for Crusoe apply to other leading-edge processors like the Merced and Itanium or the Willamette. They share a lot of things in common. Actually, I saw, I think, a couple of Intel guys haul in an Itanium sitting right here. That's very cool. I'm sorry? You're not Intel guys? Oh, God bless. Okay, so basically... I named this talk the Young Crusoe Coders Illustrated Primer, which is a ripoff of the Young Ladies Illustrated Primer, which is from a brilliant book called Diamond Age by Neil Stephenson, which you all have to read. And this quote is actually one of my favorite, but it's also germane to this talk. How many of you have read Diamond Age? Okay, I'm seeing about less than 30%, which is a crime. This is a room full of Linux coders that need to read that book. Basically, this guy creates a super high-tech, nanotech book, which he's going to give to his wealthy daughter, and it gets into the wrong hands, the wrong little girl's hands. And the little girl lives with her mother and her mother's abusive boyfriend. And her mother's abusive boyfriend picks up the book and throws it at her and calls her a four-letter word. And the book is very interactive, and so it picks up on its environment to try to bring the reader into the story. So when she later opens the book, says there once was a little girl named, right, and it gets it wrong. And later she corrects it. No, that's not my name. My name is Nell. The reason I mention that is because even the most advanced technology has bugs and verification errors, and I kind of want to talk a little bit about bugs. Because we spend most of our time at Transmeta debugging other people's software. And I'll get to that later. But basically, I'm going to talk about optimization, and then I'm going to talk about verification. And then if you want to ask some questions about mobile Linux, I'm here, and Dan Quinlan is here. Dan basically runs the project. And there might be a couple of questions we can answer. One guy earlier was impressed when I bragged that we could get Linux and X and Netscape in a very small footprint for these flash ROMs. But I'll let Dan handle any of those questions because I didn't know he was going to be here. But that's cool. So let's just start off with notebooks. You want to make sure you design in for resolution flexibility. One of the problems with a lot of apps out there is that they, for instance, games, they'll often set the resolution, and especially with this new DRI stuff in X3 4.0, you're tempted to, hey, let's just flip the resolution. That's bad. That's bad on all portables. That's bad on all internet appliances or web slates because it doubles the pixels. You've seen the effect. It looks awful. Another issue is the GUI issues. A lot of GUIs look very, very pretty now in Linux, but they're kind of designed for at least 1024, 768 up, or else there really isn't enough screen real estate to get things done. And that's another thing you have to keep an eye on. This is a theme we'll keep coming back to again and again, is that you want to wind down to some sort of blocking system call in your code. You don't want to... For instance, on Doom, we basically burned as many cycles as we could if it meant we could get a better frame rate. Bad idea. You basically want to stop doing crazy work until you know, basically, let's say you've got 25 frames per second. That's good enough for government work. Just go with that, you know. And if you sort of ease off on whatever you're doing, we can eventually go to suspend a RAM, even later suspend a disk. But these have profound effects on battery life. And some applications are very good at it. Some applications are very bad at it. A good example is the DOS command prompt, which you would think is not doing very much, but it turns out it's one of the hottest apps you can run on a processor because it's in a spin loop. And it's kind of retarded. Needless to say, Bash is a lot brighter about that. Another big one that we see a lot of is that we catch a lot of people's race conditions, timing sensitivity in their code, because they're relying on very, very sensitive clocks. When people heard about RDTSC, or what some people call the multimedia counter, they got all excited. I got excited, I admit it. I thought, oh my God, finally I've got a really accurate cycle counter. Well, it turns out we're faking it now, because so many programs, if you don't fake it, will go into conniptions because they think it's God's honest truth, real time, you know. And if you're relying on that kind of precision, you probably shouldn't be running. You won't run well on a portable notebook. If you're using that, but you're actually using it over a significant amount of time, hundreds of milliseconds, maybe seconds, then once again, you don't need to be using it because you could be using the regular PIC that's built into every PC. But either way, if you're using RDTSC and you rely on it, that's a good tip off that you're probably a little too sensitive to your timing. And even if you don't have megahertz scaling on the fly like we do, or if you're not duty cycling like the Mobile Pentium 3 does, it's going to be a problem because of APM or ACPI, which basically are constantly turning off the CPU or putting it into halt and slowing it down. So we do find a lot of these things. In the meantime, before you get a portable in your hands to test your code on there, we found a really good debugging trick is to turn off in your BIOS, is to turn off your L2. If you turn off your L2, you'll get a really screwed up performance envelope, and it'll catch a lot of interesting race conditions and other timing related issues with your code. And you can go so far as to also turn off your L1, but usually just turning off your L2 makes a huge, huge difference in verification. This is sort of a big duh, but don't use 3D hardware acceleration if you're hoping to make stuff work on portables. And I like to point out that the five best-selling games in 99 were all 2D. And there's really no reason, even if you're doing games, even if you're doing crazy sort of Geist-like funky effects, there's no reason to use 3D if you're just doing it because you think it'll improve market share. It's not the case. And it'll be a while before really cool 3D cards show up in portables because they burn a lot of power. This is actually a picture of the Voodoo 5 6000, which has its own power supply in the back of the card because the AGP can't deliver enough. And it's got four fans on it. And typically, 3D accelerators now have transistor counts which are outnumbering high-end processors. So it's going to be a while before the ones that we're all familiar with get down into the little cards. Don't forget the keyboarders. I'm a portable computer hater, and there's lots of us. And one of the reasons we hate it is what I'm doing right now, trying to navigate with this stupid mouse. And if you can come up, if you can come up with a good keyboard interface thing, that makes a huge difference. This isn't this goes without saying in a Linux room where we all come up with keyboard interfaces to our code, but it does make a big difference. Also helps us demo on show floors because we can just tap around. Again, standalone demo loops are huge. If you have some kind of cool software you're writing and you want it to get out there, believe me, a much better way than putting it on a website for everybody is to give it to several people that you know are going to shows, because they'll put it on their machine if it's flashy and cool or does something that people think is neat. And they'll show it, especially if they can show it without interacting with it, because they've got to spend their time doing this and saying, you know, buy our product. And it makes a huge difference. Another big one is that the video cards on these things have incredibly small amounts of video RAM, typically. They've got lots of RAM, they've got lots of disk space, but they just always seem to come up short on video RAM. So if you're doing anything involving page flipping, you may find that you're out of memory, and you don't want to make your code rely on that. Again, this is for the DRIers, right? And once again, don't be tempted to change to a lower resolution just to get that video memory back. So now I'm going to talk, so that's sort of about Linuxy notebooks, right? Now I'm going to talk about Linuxy web slates. And web slates are these new class of device that we started working on mobile Linux for. Basically, what they tend to have in common is that they tend not to have hard drives. And they tend instead to have maybe a wireless Ethernet to a base station that's talking to DSL to the Internet, or maybe it's a regular old POTS modem, or maybe it's wired to a DSL or wired to a cable modem. But they tend not to have hard drives. They have flash ROMs instead, which are very small and actually quite pokey too. And some of the considerations include that, you know, you need to make them small. These guys are penny pinchers. It costs about $2 a meg. And as soon as they discover that you've got a fat app, they'll axe it if it's not absolutely crucial. Again, with the web slates, you've got to design in resolution flexibility. These guys are going to have even wonkier resolutions than the portables. I've seen some cool portables with really wide aspect ratios now, and you can expect these internet appliances to do the same sort of thing. There's a couple of interesting side effects to these touch screens. It is a positional input, not a delta movement like it is with a mouse. This changes a lot of things. If your interface includes sort of a click drag, that might be a problem because you have to emulate that on the touchscreen as a click, hold down, scroll across or something like that. If you just put it down and scrolled across, it might not be clear. It's because the hardware is not getting the event, hey, he depressed the button, he released the button. It's just getting a, here's XY, here's the XY, here's the XY, here's the XY, right? And it has to filter everything from there. You will occasionally get bogus inputs, and so you have to filter this out. This is if you're doing sort of drivers. We've seen jumping as much as a quarter of an inch around the actual point you're depressing. It can be pretty bad. And the mouse buttons can be a real problem. These things don't have a lot of controls. So you have to either emulate the taps or maybe you have to use the virtual keyboard or some sort of glyph-like system. And so using the keyboard on these things is more painful. They're quite the opposite of notebooks. On notebooks, it can be easier to use the keyboard. On these web slates, it's easier if you can come up with a nice positional input system. Where you don't have to play with it too much. I think the canonical dream way that these things will be used is you've got a little web slate in your house. It's got the touchscreen on it. And you've just left it on the coffee table. You're watching TV. You're watching a movie on TV, and you say, isn't that the actor from? And then you go to your IMDb bookmark, and you start browsing, and you don't want to type in too many characters. I think her name is Emma something, and so you do that with the virtual keyboard. And then hopefully you point and click your way to the rest of it. And so you really want to avoid the keyboardy type stuff. Also really think about cool network features. There's not a lot of software out there that takes into account the fact that pretty much most Linux machines are sitting on either the internet or a pretty cool intranet. It really helps if you have a cool update mechanism. A lot of Windows software has this now. with the automatic patches. Games tend to be the pushing this the hardest, but other software is starting to do it too. You can actually do some, if you're into anti-piracy, for instance, let's say, I know all of us love open source, I'm a huge fan, but I'm also a huge fan of my day job because it pays my bills. And my day job, and all my day jobs, they're interested in IP and things like that. So should you actually have to do really effective anti-piracy measures, these websites are almost guaranteed to be plugged into the internet. So you really do have the opportunity to do some amazing things to prevent piracy. And once again, don't use anything too heavyweight for your libraries. A lot of some distributions will be able to get some sort of lean, cool support system in there for graphics or whatever. Use what they've got. Try not to say, "Oh well, all I need is GNOME and GTK and you know all these different little helper apps." It's better if you can really focus in and keep track of what resources you're using, so that if you had to, you could grab every other binary that you're using or every other piece of source for every binary you're using in addition to your project and then put that all together. That really tells you what the footprint of your application is. So that's kind of it for the Linux notebooks and websites. Now I'm going to kind of talk about Crusoe optimizations. And once again, although these get pretty specific and it's really designed for assembly hackers, kernel hackers, that sort of thing, at the same time, a lot of these apply to other next-generation processors just because we share a lot of features like being VLIW and having, you know, interesting iCache problems and having, you know, all trying to enjoy statically optimized code as opposed to decoding and rescheduling on every iteration. So basically, the first one is to make your app benchmarkable. At Transmeta, we have a really kick-ass, I mean, I was blown away when I got there and saw the automation department. We have some unbelievable automation. We take tons of applications and we wire them up with Perl and bits of string. And every time we do a source code check-in to CMS, it runs a battery of tests, benchmarks of all kinds, games, all sorts of stress tests. And it gives us, we can go to a web page a little bit later, and it'll give us all the scores. It'll give us whether it ran, whether these operating systems booted, whether all these things worked, and how well they worked, right? That's really interesting. Hey, who here has a cell phone or a pager? Yeah, turn it off. Basically, if you have a benchmarkable application, I think I'll turn mine off. If you have a benchmarkable application, that makes a huge difference to us. We are thrilled. We are happy to optimize our CPU to your program, not the other way. We're willing to do it that way instead of the other way around. And we can do it very, very quickly. Even for intractable problems, x86 Windows code mixed with real mode, we can, you know, with no source code, no symbol tables, we can often come up with an optimization for it within weeks or a couple of months. That's the gross case. What we would much prefer is to have source code, which is why we love Linux. But so I can't stress this enough. If you've got some cool app and you can put a benchmarking mode in there, we will love on you big time. Another common mistake that people don't understand is that we're not executing x86 code. We're always executing what we call P95 code or the Crusoe native instruction set. And that code starts out by reading x86 code in and interpreting it slowly and learning about it. And then eventually translates it, puts it in a translation buffer and executes it as native code. But it never actually executes x86. And the reason this is important is because the iCache reflects the P95 code, not the x86 code. So it doesn't really matter how big, it doesn't really directly matter how big how bloated your x86 code is. It's what it translates to that makes a difference. Because the x86 will pollute the data cache for a little while until it's translated, and then we'll basically never touch it. So that's kind of an important point. But also just the fact that we do have varying speeds on this stuff. Self-modifying code terrifies us. When we were first learning the ropes and we started running Quake, we were sort of dismayed, and we thought this thing was faster than that. But then we discovered Quake was heavily using self-modifying code. Fortunately, it was using a pretty intelligent variant of it, which is basically just patching immediates and patching address offsets, which we created a hack for. This is a perfect example where, at the time, they didn't have source, they just worked around it. They saw the behavior they saw the x86 behavior, and they said, okay, look, let's make it so that instead of letting it patch the immediates, we'll go ahead and let it patch the immediates in x86 space, and then in the translations, we'll always refer to the x86 space immediates instead of importing them into the P95 translations. So we can do stuff like that, but please don't use it. this is a perfect example of where we saw that happening in Quake. We also saw it happening heavily in the Windows 95, 98 Glit engine called DibEng. And DibEng was just a nightmare. We had to come up with something we called the undead mechanism to handle that, because it would basically, every time you call the bitblit call, it basically blasts out a new piece of code. It's actually, you look at first, I was like, these morons, And then I looked at it and looked at it and I was like, wow, this is impressive. This is how I would have done it if I was a huge man, right? But they didn't know at the time that they'd be killing these new next generation processors that are depending on translations and sort of a static behavior to code. So please don't get too ambitious with that. Some good news is that we do have lots and lots of registers, and we use clever techniques called aliasing to basically turn short distance references, like stack variables, for example, into registers. So maybe your x86 code, one of your operands, basically refers to a stack variable and then writes it back and reads it out and writes it back. We can actually turn all the reads into a register read, and so it basically turns into a non-operation. It's not really fetching anything. When you do writes, we do have to write it back just in case we get interrupted or something. But we do some amount of aliasing, which is kind of cool. Alrighty. Here's another big one we've seen. Please don't use artificial benchmarks for your timing. There are major industry benchmarks which our customers force us to do well on, which literally do things like they start out with an artificial benchmark. Before the real benchmark runs, they start with an artificial benchmark, and they say, let's get an idea for how fast this processor is. We'll give it about 5 milliseconds to find out just how fast it is. But, all right, now we'll run the benchmark in a human amount of time. We're basically going to try to make the benchmark run about the same amount of real-time seconds, no matter what machine you run it on. But we'll use this little mini benchmark to find out how fast it is, right? And so for us, where we start out slow, learning the code with the interpreter, that little miniature benchmark makes us look awful, right? And then we're given this short window to really learn and ramp up and kick butt, right? And this isn't just going to hurt us; it's going to hurt other processors as well. So this is a real problem that affects all modern processors that are using some kind of real-time translation. Always try to create an actual walkthrough of your engine as opposed to an artificial startup thing. Function pointers, sometimes they're good, sometimes they're bad. And again, this affects lots of different processors. Basically, if you're saying jump to whatever's in EAX, then it's really hard for us to figure out, oh God, what's an EAX, right? What if the instruction before that, we took an interrupt, and the interrupt handler changed EAX, and then it comes back? We can't really cleverly chained to wherever it's going to jump to, right? So it really helps us if you can go just do a direct jump, because we can do just the opposite with those. We can optimize those away to nothing. If you do an unconditional branch, we can just say, we know where it goes, we'll just make it one fat translation, or we'll just chain it to that translation, right? Sometimes function pointers are optimized away. For instance, if you're in C++ and you've got virtual methods and you set the virtual method, and it kind of stays that way for a while, we'll realize, hey, this is cool. Let's just do a chain and then do a quick sanity check on the other side to make sure that it's where we think we are. Right? ICAST locality, I kind of mentioned this. We are executing VLIW code, not x86. This hurts us. It hurts the poor Itanium even more. We've got what I consider a fairly bloated instruction word with 128 bits and four atoms in it, right? And the Itanium has 128 and only three atoms in it. So this hurts both of us. Please be careful with these things. Because we spend a lot of transistors on iCache. For instance, we have about a 64K just iCache. But it's not as big as it sounds. It's actually quite a bit smaller if you think of it in terms of the x86 code it represents, right? So thankfully, this is a Linux crowd, so I don't have to tell you not to use SMI or real node code. we've been playing with the idea at work in the Mobile Linux team of either adopting or maybe hacking ourselves on getting rid of the BIOS entirely just to speed up boot times. I don't know if you guys saw that cool open BIOS project on the /dot, but real mode code is bad. Let's see, partial register stalls. I don't know if you remember this from the Pentium Pro, but we don't suffer from it. On the other hand, these registers, the AH through DH, can execute more slowly. If it's a bunch of H to H register transfers, then we can optimize those out. But if you're playing with AH and AL and AX and EAX, you know, that sort of thing, we do have to rotate those particular ones in and out of the code. So if you're trying to do any clever table lookup stuff, be careful of those. Not unlike the Willamette, which is Intel's next killer x86. Crusoe IMULs are not single cycle operations. This was something that we got to enjoy for a narrow. I mean, you remember from your CS class that add and subtract is much faster than multiply and divide, and then suddenly Intel gave us the single cycle multiply, which kind of blew everybody away. And for a while there, all was good, but it's going to get bad again. So go back into your CS mode of thinking because those do get more expensive. We have the nice benefit of being able to look at it at the IMUL you're doing. If you're doing it by a small immediate, we've got a couple of cool ops that we use to optimize that away into shifts and adds. FXchange is mostly free, just like it is in the Pentium 2s and that line. So that means basically you can express several floating point operations that you're doing at the same time. Because if you play with this, you know it's a floating point stack and you can't randomly access the registers, which tends to serialize what you're doing. But if you use FXchange, you can basically get rid of the serialization. So that's good. Like I said, unconditional branches will eventually become free. This is another big one. If you're into using heavy floating point, you want to mask all exceptions in the floating point status register, and you want to avoid denorm operands like the plague. They cause real problems when you get down there. If we get an explicit F load of a denorm, it'll usually work. But if you're doing an F mul of a denorm memory reference, problems, right? So it's a sufficiently messy problem that you just kind of want to avoid them if you can. You don't want to mix x86 instructions and writable data on the same 4K page. I'll bet you can guess why this is. this to us looks just like paging, right? It's as if the OS just brought in a new page of code and overwrote the old page of code, which means all of our translations on that page are invalid, right? So if you're constantly writing to some data variable on the same 4K page as some x86 code, that's sufficiently close to the code that we go, ah, you know, we better remake all of our translations there, and we lose all that, work we did. Again, this really tended to appear only in Windows. It was mainly a Windows problem. We haven't really seen it in Linux. So, but a lot of you guys are uber kernel hackers and tend to have jobs working on all kinds of crazy things, including new operating systems. So, don't make critical loops shorter than like 10 instructions. Right? So, we need an opportunity to schedule the atoms well. And the longer your loop, the better we can do on scheduling. And it is kind of a delicate balance between loop unrolling and not loop unrolling. On the one hand, a nice tight loop is really good for the iCache pressure, right? On the other hand, it does make things kind of hard to schedule. An unrolled loop is harder on the iCache pressure, but it helps things get scheduled. So if you want to unroll it maybe an iteration or two, that usually helps, especially if it's hot. If it's really hot, you just do whatever you need to do. But a couple of unrolls can be really helpful to us because we see more, it communicates more information to us semantically. We get to see, oh, look, this really doesn't depend on that. Let's just put these in registers. Don't use really peculiar super complex instructions in the middle of a tasty hot loop. There's some instructions which I list here, CPU ID, compare exchange, load CS, write MSR, read MSR, push A, RDTSC, BTS. All these things become what we call out-of-line handlers. They're sufficiently rare instructions that we didn't want to burn translator space or on doing them super optimized within the code you're executing. And they also tended to contribute to translation cache bloat. So if you have a read MSR that was inlined into your hot loop, or even if it's not hot, it just becomes this giant thing that tests for all the cases, for all the different MSRs you're reading, and that's not cool. So the problem with, that's usually a good thing, and people tend not to use those in hot loops, but some people do. Like I've seen RDTSC in hot loops, I've seen CPU ID in warmish loops. You want to be careful with those. PCI writes, you want to write consecutive 32-bit words. That way we've got the PCI controller built into the CPU, so there's a PCI bus coming off the CPU, right? And that means we can basically start the burst writes and stuff if we see this. So if you want to write consecutive to PCI space, we'll see it and burst it, and we can do very long bursts. Most people know this, but if you're doing any kind of graphics stuff, it does not pay to do all your work in the frame buffer. It always pays to do your work in main memory and then do a final DMA transfer to the frame buffer or even a PIO transfer. It's still a win. Let's see. Keep an eye on that floating point stack pointer. This is a problem we saw in Abe's Odd World. They weren't keeping track of their floating point stack pointer and constantly overflow and generate exceptions and problems. This we compensated for with our higher end part, but that is a problem. And you should keep track of any assembly code you write or any compiler code you write that you do have a conservation of floating point registers on coming in and leaving. Don't use segmentation. Again, in Linux, this tends not to be a problem, but you want to use the flat mode. You want to use the giant flat mode as opposed to crazy segmented stuff. Again, in the TM5400, we sort of compensated for this, but it's not a pleasant thing. This is kind of a duh. Make sure all your data references are aligned. We've seen some compilers that won't 8-byte align their stacks, which causes all kinds of performance problems if you're pushing doubles and that sort of thing. Make sure your working set fits in the data cache. another duh. Again, it helps us. It helps us if you use 32-bit floats instead of larger ones. Just like the Intel parts, we can take shortcuts. If we don't have to propagate all the bits out, we can just say, hey, look, let's make this a lot faster. So this does help. Don't ever, ever, ever use the CPU ID string for anything terribly important. So I'm not sure if OpenGL, I'm pretty sure OpenGL is still this way in a sense, but you basically have to get the vendor string and then look up in a database, here's the list of capabilities of this 3D card. That blows. And this is the way people used to do it with CPUs. They'd say, okay, let's see what model CPU this is. That way we'll find out whether it supports MMX, KNI, 3D Now, conditional moves. That's a bad thing. Inside the CPU ID instruction, there's another mode to get the capability bits out. Always use that instead. This has caused no end of headaches for... That's an interesting problem. This caused a lot of headaches for AMD and Cyrix, and it's something about me standing here or something. AMD and Cyrix and Centaur. Where do you think this is?
The signal
cable. I screwed it in. It's nice and tight. Oh well, this is my new green presentation. Anyway, basically, this is the green moving presentation. the great penguin is with us. Basically, use a CPID. The next one is kind of a big one for us, MMX and floating point. We need you to keep four independent operations in flight at all times if you can. We see a lot of MMX code where it basically assumes that it's getting single cycle latency, and so I can work on this register, and on the next instruction, boy, it'll be ready to go. And so you see very small loops with basically totally serialized code. If you can find other things to do and keep several ops in flight at the same time, boy, that helps a lot. Again, if you're writing kernel code, don't sit there and do spin locks. Execute the halt instruction. It makes a big difference on power if you're waiting for an interrupt. And let's see. Like I said, the apparent speed of your processor can vary vastly over time. And here's another power-ish tip. If you're basically trying to get into a low power state, or even if you're not, it's good to turn off other sources of DMA. DMA, because the PCI controller is built into our chip, turns on the chip, right? So basically, if you can turn off as many DMA sources as possible, it helps power a lot. This also actually affects other CPUs as well, because if you turn off the DMA for a different, even for a separate north bridge on a different processor, those north bridges also sometimes have low power states, and you wake them up when you start a DMA transfer. On our part, some of the DMA controller is soft, some of it is hard. So when you do DMA, it does steal some cycles. It's kind of a common misconception that DMAs from, for instance, main memory to a peripheral are free to the CPU. The CPU can just keep on trucking, but in fact, it does take memory bandwidth, obviously, away from the CPU. And sometimes for snooping protocols, it can take away even host bus performance. So, now I kind of wanted to talk about what we want to hear from you guys. When there are parts out there, right? We can very easily and promptly patch any bug that you have, just let us know. As long as it's not a race condition on some other application's behalf, right? We can do bug fixes very quickly. Also, if you see stuff and you say, "Hey, look, I really want an MSR that tells me the following stats," those are really easy to put in because we don't have to do much verification on them because the MSRs are basically, you know, break compatibility with everybody else. It's fine. So we love those. We get a lot of questions for, "Oh God, wouldn't it be cool if a Crusoe was running native?" No, it sure wouldn't. And I'll tell you why. We've got hardcore hardware engineers and hardcore software engineers. And by the way, we're always looking for more. So this is my recruiting session as well. But some of the things we did is we removed hardware interlocking, right? A lot of people are used to, "Hey, if I execute this instruction, it outputs data to this register, and then I use it in the next instruction in this register. You know, maybe that's not going to pipeline well, so stall the processor." Well, not on ours. Our processor never stalls. It just, the data isn't ready, and you get crap in there, right? So what we did is we trained our assembly coders to do the right thing. We wrote tools to make sure that we're not doing any silly stuff like that. We made sure our GCC backend for P95 didn't screw up like that. So in CMS, we have complete control of what's going on, right? But if we provided native code to the rest of the world, you can bet, you know, that somebody would get it wrong. So, and it's not just, "Oh, this will give you garbage in there." Sometimes it'll actually damage the processor. So it is a super, super bad idea. And memory protection, one of the other optimizations we have is that we didn't have to put code page memory protection in there, right? Because we're always executing CMS code. We're always executing the private piece of memory. The only protection we have is that we don't execute anything in x86 memory, right? So that's all we had to put in there. Really cool savings, saved us a lot of time, things we didn't have to verify or worry about. At the same time, this is why native doesn't work. Now, we might, I'll explain this further below. If we get a lot of, not a public outcry, but a lot of people saying, you know, sure, it'd be cool. We x86 is swell and all. We like it because there's lots of x86 drivers and x86 Netscape plugins and x86 BIOSes and firmwares and stuff. But sure, it'd be nice if at the same time we could use something more efficient, right? X86 has a lot of side effects, which sort of pollutes the semantics of what you're trying to communicate in your assembly code. And if there's some flavor of assembly that you guys feel is much more clear, is much more effective, then we're happy to entertain it. But we do need, like, coherent proposals, and it would take time because there's nothing... We're not aware of any killer apps for that yet, although lots of engineers have these sneaking suspicions that somewhere out there there's a killer app for that sort of thing. For instance, one of the things I demoed at E3 is, and that we showed off at the launch, is that we did a Pico Java personality that runs parallel to the x86 personality. These personalities are basically just front ends, and they both share the same back end scheduler. And we took Doom and we compiled it all into x86, except for the rasterizers, which we compiled from C into Pico Java bytecode, which I know sounds weird, but it is a full machine language, so why not? And then we created a special x86 instruction to jump into the Pico Java and a special Pico Java instruction to jump into the x86. And then we ran that, running the x86 most of the time, jumping into Pico Java just for the rasterization, the vertical and horizontal line draws, and then jumping back into the x86 again. And it ran just as fast as the native x86 version. And this was 3 months hacking, a couple of engineers, and this is sort of a tribute to how much clearer some machine languages are than others. But so we do believe that there might be value there somewhere, but we kind of want to hear about it. If you have a big budget application, again, we're the little guys, so we can't say, "You know, you better do this, you morons." We're much more inclined to say, "Oh, please, dear God, let us optimize our CPU to your really cool application, because we love you guys." So if you have really big budget things, we're a very small company. I think we're on the order of low hundreds, right? And we don't have staff to go flying around optimizing everybody's stuff, but a couple of big budget projects we can look at, and we'd love to fix bugs early before they become a big released problem. Symbol tables. This is something that applies even to the Linux crowd. A lot of people think, hey, if I just release my source code, and even if there's binary RPMs and binary devs, which is everybody's really going to grab, they've got all the tools they need to debug whatever this problem is. That's not exactly true. Some of the problems come up as interactions between compilers and your software. So the binary version that we see a bug in might be due to an interaction between an older compiler and the particular binary version that's available in RPM or dev or whatever. And it sure would be helpful to us to have symbol tables. In Windows, we have nothing, right, which is horrible. But I often get on my hands and knees and go to other companies, Windows software developers, and say, oh, please give us your symbol tables, because it does make our debugging job a lot easier. And again, we're typically debugging other people's software. our CPU is really stable. It has been stable for a long time. And it's just stunning to see how many bugs pop up because of a different performance envelope. So that helps us a lot. And let's see. Good Lord. We're almost at the end. And here's where I basically talk about... I don't know. Okay, so I don't know how many of you guys knew this, but I actually came from the game industry. I was one of the guys who wrote Doom and Quake, and then I started a small company, Crack.com, and made a little scroller called Abuse. Actually, the last talk I gave was at Linux Expo or something like that. It was a Red Hat thing a long time ago, and I was basically saying how Golgotha was going to be the greatest game since sliced bread, and then we ran out of money and crashed and burned. But anyway, after that, I got all these tasty offers at various game companies. They love failures even more than they like a success, because they think you've been through the ringer, and they intend to put you through the ringer. So all these tasty things, but Transmeta just blew me away as kind of, you know, here's sci-fi, gee-whiz kind of stuff happening. But it's really been educational to me, because I've seen a completely different side of software development, which is software taken from the point of verification. And I know this sounds dull, and I still remember the stupid software engineering flowchart in my limited CS. I'm actually a double E major, but in my limited CS courses, they would say, you know, write the code, compile it, debug it, go back to write code, debug, write, release, you know? And that was pretty much the simplified version of software engineering. And there was never after the, you know, right before the release, you know, work on your verification suites, you know, beat the living crap out of this thing, then release, right? And automated verification makes a huge difference. The stuff I've seen come out of software houses is so much worse than hardware. Our software team, which has some of the best, I mean, a lot of people think, oh, God, what was it like to work with John Carmack? It was really cool. He's a brainy, brainy, smart guy. We've got two walls of John Carmack's at Transmeta, and constantly, you know, brains popping out of their ears. And these guys were blown away by how much harder hardware guys work on verification than software guys do. And so SourceForge is really cool. It sure would be cool if there's a TestForge out there, because we see tons and tons of verification issues. Like I said, automation is a huge thing. If you can find out a way to automate your tests, you can find out, especially if you link it to your check-ins, you can find out so quickly where that damn bug creeped in. And you'd be surprised how many people don't do this. It really does require a full-time guy focusing on this constantly to keep a farm of machines up, to constantly make all the pearly kind of hacky things to make it all work all the time, to constantly add more test suites to your software. But I can't think of a single project which couldn't use a full-time automation guy, at least one. We have a small team of them. Another thing about hardware bugs, a lot of people think hardware just works. You know, that's the thing you can trust. I remember when I first discovered that Malloc was broken, right? And I was just offended to the core. How could this be broken, right? It's much worse than you think. I mean, everything's broken. There's broken CPUs, there's broken memory, there's broken north bridges. I mean, there's lots of broken north bridges. There's broken sound cards, lots of those, broken IDE controllers. So many things are broken, and so many broken things ship. And literally, it's like getting a cake out of the oven. Sometimes it's going to be good, sometimes it's not going to be good. And they try to focus on making all the cakes good, but you just get bad ones. And it's not uncommon. It's not uncommon at all. So when you're doing serious software development, always buy your hardware in at least pairs or triples or something like that so that you can literally swap them out. You do get bad cards. You do get bad memory. Another thing we weren't really considering was memory testing that much. I actually thought ECC memory just pretty much can't go wrong, right? Well, it can. And it goes wrong all the time. And you want to do thorough memory tests of this in that same automation farm. You want to be beating on your hardware to make sure that there's not something you're missing. Also, a big difference, and even when I was doing in my game company, I was harping on this, but multi-platform development is big. If you guys, I know this sort of sounds blasphemous, but if you actually do a Windows version of whatever software you're writing using Cygwin, I mean, I hate actually being in Windows. There's something, my fingers just don't like it. But I don't mind treating it as sort of an embedded system, which I do cross-compiles to. And it's really actually quite pleasant once you get the hang of it. Cygwin 32 is really a cool package, and you can compile a lot of really cool Unixy apps straight into Windows. It just works, and it helps your not just your portability, but your debugging effort immensely. You can very quickly isolate, oh wow, this is a portable bug. I mean, what are the odds that it's not my fault? It pretty much probably is, right? So those are kind of the big points I wanted to make on optimization. And I haven't really touched on mobile Linuxy things or any other questions, but I wanted to open up to. I warned in the abstract that it would be a beefy Q&A session. I'm not sure where we are on time, but have at it if you have any questions about Crusoe or mobile Linux or whatever. Yeah, go ahead.
You mentioned that unrolling loops and trying to get four constructions on the fly at one time is a good thing.
Sort of two different tips, but yeah.
Yeah, they're two different tips. However, I code in C or C++.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Profiling may show, hey, I've got a problem in here, but how do I force things to go?
You can start by just looking at your C code and seeing whether the next line always depends on the last line, right? If the next line of C depends on the line two lines or three lines before it, that's better than if your next line always depends on the last line. So if you're doing completely serialized computations in C, odds are pretty good you'll get completely serialized computations in assembly. There's a lot of really smart compilers that will try to help find the parallelism in the operations you're doing, but it really does help if you think about it yourself and try to structure your C to do these different things yourself. You can start by, as long as you see the parallelism, you can start by writing it serially and then sort of rearrange it later. You shouldn't have to do that. It really should be the compiler's job. But that's mainly a suggestion to the compiler writers, right? So I'm trying to talk to them saying, please, there's this guy over here who uses C and C++. Don't screw him over. Any other questions? Yeah.
You mentioned that using VTSC is a bad idea.
Yeah.
What do you recommend when you use an application like a video scheduler where you do need media?
So Alan Cox, did you go to Alan Cox's Video for Linux talk? Yeah. Buffering is kind of the key to these issues. In video streaming, you can buffer, and you do have more than a millisecond of time to do your measurements. And the PIC has microsecond accuracy, which you get at through get time of day, for example. And you can, as long as you're looking at a window of on the order of, you know, human scale, a half a second, something perceivable by humans. It's much better than looking at RDTSC where you're trying to, you literally have a resolution of millionths or billionths of a second. That's a problem. When you depend on that resolution, that's when it's a problem. It's okay to use RDTSC as long as you're using it over a large enough time that you're really getting an average behavior as opposed to a really tiny instantaneous one, which you very rarely need. And you can get around some of those instantaneous needs in video streaming by just, you know, lots of buffering.
What's a big amount of time? 30 milliseconds?
Hundreds of milliseconds is much better. That makes a huge difference if you're in that scale. There's lots of ACPI modes which have latencies on the order of tens of milliseconds. So just those power-saving modes, never mind the CRISA, it'll screw up a lot of things. If you're, for instance, let's say you wrote a DVD player in Linux, right? And why are you chuckling? Holy shit. Fucking A. I love you. Okay. So let's say you write the DVD. You actually do. It's someday, maybe not right now. In pure software, you may be able to get it so it's not using 100% of the CPU, right? And when it's at that stage, you want to make sure that the processors... It's what? You do a sleep, right? But even if you don't do a sleep, ACPI may decide, okay, now it's time to go into a low power state, which increases, it takes a chance. It increases the latency of what, so you said, I want my sleep to be this many seconds, right? This many milliseconds, rather. And it may not do it that many milliseconds. You know this, it's not always accurate, right? That's a perfect example of where using the really fine-grained timing can screw you up, right? Because it may come back later. You maybe took that into account with your fine-grained timing. And ACPI is undirected. It could kick in the middle of it doing something important. So it's mostly the best thing you can do, especially as a DVD player, where you don't need like real-time feedback. You do need... I mean, you can decode several buffers full, for example. It's a lot of memory and maybe crazy, but if you're actually decoding way ahead of where you're showing, and you have time to be careful about what you're showing, as opposed to I want to decode and show on the same in the same little piece of code. That's safer than doing this kind of it's got to be ready just in time kind of thing. Am I making sense?
Yeah, there's the trade-off of doing it that way, though, is the cache footprint is too big.
I mean, when you're decoding a frame of DVD, your cache footprint's too big anyway. a DVD frame is much larger than your cache. It's much larger than your L2. So you're blowing away the cache anyway. Really, the important thing is whether you're getting good cache locality when you are using the cache. So if you're only touching one byte out of each cache line, that blows, right? But you're not. You're touching all of them, and you're doing quite a bit of operations for each one. So I don't think you'll be in trouble. But if you have questions, you know Nathan Laredo probably. He works at Transmeta, and he's happy to explain any of this stuff to you if you want, or if you have issues with that. But yeah. Yeah. So his question is, can I tell him more about the internals of the CRISO architecture, how many floating point operations we can do, that sort of thing? I can. I'm fully capable of that, but I'd rather not. We're putting together a much more technical developer support program, which I wouldn't want to either contradict or spin incorrectly. And that should be coming out sometime this fall. So I'd rather sort of defer that kind of question until then. Well, I think the white paper explains what the floating point MMX resources are. We have a floating point MMX unit. The performance on floating point MMX is sort of like a regular Pentium, but clocked really high, right? As opposed to a Pentium 2 clocked really high, right? So that's kind of the rule of thumb, but it's kind of hard to quantify. I mean, is there a specific thing you were curious about? What sort of application are you working on? So in assembly or C or? Use GCC or? So what we're probably, I can probably get for you much sooner is the exact compile flags to use in GCC, because we have lots of GCC experts at Transmeta, and we can tell you exactly the best one to use. But I think it's basically the, I think the tastiest stuff in general, assuming you're running on portables, is like dash M486 with dash capo, lowercase s, which optimizes for size. And 486 gets rid of a lot of the alignment restrictions. So it's, although it introduces a couple others, there might be a better one. But I can ask if that's, if that would help you. I saw one over here earlier. Is there another question? Yeah. Okay, so his question was, could I break down where we get our, most of our power savings, right? Which parts are from the VLIW core and which parts are from the power saving, how aggressive we are with the power saving states. I'd say, you want numbers? Damn, you probably want numbers. I can give you a rough idea. I don't actually know the numbers. The guy to talk to about the real numbers is Mark Fleischman. It's Mark F, Mark with a C, at transmeta.com. But from the using VLIW, we get a big transistor count win, which lowers the capacitance of the overall chip. That helps quite a bit. The long run support, where we vary our megahertz on the fly, helps a lot for the streaming kind of DVD stuff. The main reason it helps is because the streaming apps are sensitive to speed changes, and they don't like the jerky. They don't like the jerky duty cycling behavior or the jerky ACPI-ish, APM-ish behavior as much as they like the nice, smooth, okay, it's slower, but that's fine. At least it's predictable performance. So that makes a huge difference on power for those applications.
Is that something that it will dynamically figure out? Or suppose you have hard real-time deadlines that you need to wake up after a certain amount of time?
Yeah, it does dynamically figure it out. It looks at how often we're in halt. It looks how often the north bridge is telling us to go to, the south bridge is telling us to go to sleep, and it figures out it won't undersupply your, it always errs on the oversupply side, so it'll ramp up very quickly if you suddenly need CPU performance. Is there? I don't know what other bits to help you with. So our ACPI states are lower power, primarily because we have this. Smaller core, and we're also very careful. The hardware engineers were very careful at the time they designed the part to make it so that they could shut down various regions of the VLIW of the core very gracefully. No, that's not even accessible to CMS. By the way, if anybody wants to do native P95 coding, I recommend you come work for us as opposed to. Worrying about an API, but and if anybody has questions about that, please see me. We are hiring like crazy right now. I hope I answered your question. Okay, yeah.
How do you map decoded instruction addresses to code addresses in the actual code branch?
So you're saying, how do I map a logical branch target to a P95 branch target? What we eventually do. That's an excellent question. That would really suck if you did that on the fly, wouldn't it? Yes, he's full of brains. Okay, so basically the question is, you're jumping to some logical address in your x86 code, but we've translated it to P95 code. So do we have to have some monster 4-gig lookup table that says, oh, this address goes here? No, that's not the way to do it. What you do is you basically put a search engine on it, and you do it the slow-ass way and go, I've got all these translations here. I wonder which one it is, right? And then eventually you figure it out. It doesn't take long. And then after you've done that a couple times, you say, oh, wait a minute, I keep going to the same one. So you patch your translation to do a unconditional jump straight to that other translation. And then in that translation, you put a quick little, we made a single atom called cat, which is able to go in sort of a free slot, which does a quick check. to make sure that we didn't go to the wrong place. And so it's a virtually free check, and it basically turns the branch into, so it goes from being an intractable problem to being a zero cycle problem. So it's actually pretty cool. It's a pretty cool solution to that problem. Yeah.
An interesting dual to that is how do debuggers work when you're doing
Oh, good Lord. Our debuggers are real men. I'll start by saying that. We took GDB and we made it sort of dual personality so that it understood both x86 and P95. We have a pair of wires that we can attach to the CPU directly from another machine over I2C, and we can GDB talks straight to that. So you can run the computer and you can literally hit Control C and the CPU stops. And then we can find out what translation we're in. And each translation has an entry in the translation table which tells you which x86 code that correlates to. Now, the translation is heavily scheduled stuff that is hard to for humans to decode. And so you have to kind of use the force to grok where in the x86 code you are. But the translations tend to be short enough that you can usually do it. Plus, we tend to assign EAX, EBX, ECX, all those guys to the same set of P95 registers. So once again, it's kind of easy to correlate. When we're trying to debug and we need to know exactly which DAM instruction it is that's breaking, we'll turn off translations and we'll put it in interpreter mode only. And then we'll reboot. Everything will run a lot slower, of course. And then we have perfect, oh, it died in this instruction. All right. So that's kind of, We use sort of a multi-pronged approach to debugging. We also have some brilliant tools which let us do things like do on-the-fly x86 instruction traces, which come over. I mean, it's better than, I don't know if you guys have heard of VTune from Intel, but it's kind of the best system-wide Windows profiling tool. And it's probably better than what we have in Linux and things like gprof because it is system-wide. But this actually beats them all. we can actually hit Control-C, in GDB, prof start, and then say continue, and it runs for a while. And then we hit Control-C and say prof dump, and it'll tell us which translations were the hottest, which x86 code is the hottest, and you know we can totally look from a system-wide view. It really is cool. If you want to get into this kind of geeky stuff, come talk to me. I'd love to recruit you. Yes.
Is this not something that the kind of engine can optimize by itself? If a loop is too short, it will unroll the loop?
Yeah, so his question is, some of my tips were please unroll the loop and keep several operations in flight. Isn't this something that your translator can do itself and figure out? The answer is yes, we can, and we do. In fact, we do unroll loops. We do actually reschedule what looks like serial code if we find that they aren't truly interdependent. But the thing is, we still have to abide by the letter of the law of your x86 code. Your x86 code does have side effects that aren't intended. And so if you can communicate to us semantically, look, I've unrolled it, which basically shows you for damn sure the parallelism here. And here are the things I put in flight semantically. So I'm communicating this to you, CMS. And we can go, we can be more aggressive with this. Let's go to the wall and really do something clever. So yeah, there are a lot of really advanced compiler techniques in the CMS backend. We do loop unrolling. We do CSE. We do code movement. We do all kinds of stuff. And even some things that aren't done in compilers because it's happening dynamically. I don't know if you guys have heard of HP's Dynamo, but it's a really clever idea. They basically took PA RISC and they made a PA RISC engine that just runs it on a PA RISC, which sort of makes you think, this is retarded, right? You're already running on a PA RISC. Why are you putting it through a translator. Well, the reason it does that is because it can find dynamic optimization opportunities that you can't find statically, and it actually will run PA-RISC native code faster on PA-RISC. So we do the exact same thing, and it is a really big win. Oh, did you have a follow-up? It's okay to use stack registers, right? If you're using stack registers and you have to keep referring to them, especially if there are lots of reads, yeah, that's fine. So yeah, his point was, if you're doing MMX and there is a register starvation in MMX, should I put the data somewhere else? And yes, the answer is make them stack variables off of ESP. You don't have to use UDP, and we'll see it, and we'll alias those, and as long as you're not constantly writing to them, as long, especially if they're sort of reference-y type things where you're reading for them a lot, we turn them into registers, the references disappear. So that's a cool way to do it. So you've probably been reading the Intel optimization manual for a long time that, hey, you know, it's okay to do MMX with a memory operand. It's just as fast as doing it with a register operand. The same is basically true of us. So as long as you keep just reading it in from there, we actually do quite well. We eat those right up. So I think I saw another hand up there. Yeah.
For the optimization for a number of the sixth generation x86 processors were to use RISC-like instructions.
Could you translate sixth generation into names I recognize?
P6, the Pentium Pro, Pentium 2.
Okay, all right.
I think they preferred the smaller, more RISC-like operations instead of the longer...
The UOPs, yeah.
But I've heard that with the seventh generation, like the Williamette, they're moving back towards the CISC and saying, no, let our hardware handle that kind of translation. Don't try and second guess our processor. What does Crusoe prefer? Does it prefer the micro-ops that can be translated into the atoms, or does it prefer to try and do its own breakup of the CISC?
So, did you guys all hear him? Okay. No, he didn't hear him. So, basically, he's saying... in the P2-ish, P3-ish cores, P-Pro-ish cores, they were very much into these simpler operations that have been introduced in the 46 days instead of using the crazy stuff. And then you let it reschedule them, and it reschedules them to UOPs on the fly. And then on the new stuff, on the Willamette, they basically are using much wider operations internally, and they don't want you to try to second-guess the processor and how to optimize for it. They kind of just want to look at your code and figure out the best thing to do. I'm not quite sure how to answer that, except that we do share a lot of attributes with Willamette-type processors, Willamette, Merced-type stuff. Yes, they do use this idea called a trace cache, where they're looking at your instruction stream, and they're translating the stream into the series of VLIW instructions, sort of VLIW instructions, and they're keeping that trace there as opposed to your loop. So maybe it'll be a couple of iterations through your loop, maybe it'll be something like that, but it's very trace-oriented. And we share much of those same issues. For instance, if you're going on a loop, his question earlier was, what happens if you jump to a logical address? And yes, we eventually chain to a new translation. Well, we look at that and say, wow, wouldn't it be cool if that code was right next to each other so that we could get these atoms that are near each other scheduled even a little bit better and save another couple of molecules. And so we'll actually sometimes just say, hey, screw this. Let's not make them separate anymore. Let's make it a trace that's continuous and all beautifully scheduled. So we share those attributes with this new breed of processors coming out. We just appear to be coming out to market a little bit earlier on those, so we're sort of on the education front. Was there? I saw another hand. Anything else? Yeah. Actually, let me ask yours because I answered your question lamely last time. Okay. Hurt?
Yes.
So his question is, what sort of standard optimization techniques hurt us? And his example was, if you unroll too much, it generates too much iCache pressure. Actually, the example you gave is a problem that affects all the processors out right now, right? If you unroll too much, it hurts your iCache because the other iCaches are much smaller. I can't think of too many things. I guess one of them is the function pointer thing. One of the manly ways theoretically to do really cool parsing is to basically shove the byte into AH or something, right? And we get the double whammy of, oh Christ, you're screening with AH, and oh yeah, oh great, now you're jumping to EAX. Ah! So we and other modern processors suck wind at that. That used to be a really cool kind of assembly hacker's hack. But it's not so cool anymore, where we're trying to look at the big picture as opposed to the specific things like that. When you're doing that, I've actually found you're not saving a lot of time even on the old fashioned stuff just because of branch penalties now. So
does your optimization
CMS, yeah. CMS. Code morphing software. So his question is, what's our branch prediction like? And the other question was, do we hoist loads? Do we prefetch stuff? God damn, you ask all the good questions. Why don't you just work for us, and then I'll just give you the whole ISO, and you can just go. All right. These are kind of sensitive things I was asked not to talk about. I'm sorry. I saw you raise your hand again. Oh, I just meant the fellow behind you, but you go. yeah, I meant you go with the water.
Could you program directly to the 95 instruction set
and bypass all the SDCs? You could. His question is, can you program directly the native P95 instruction set? Instead of embarrassing you with this slide that says, don't do that, please, I'd like to say that I actually worked on a project which I called X-Rated, because it was a naked interface to the P95, to do just that, and eventually saw the error in my ways. I was just being a little assembly bit head and saying, I want to squeeze a little more power out, because we did some native benchmarks. We saw a little performance improvement, but it got to where the architecture was so good. I mean, and I'm not tooting our own horn, but it really is amazing that CMS actually, I think, generally gets within 20% of its peak native performance executing x86, which is a semantically ugly language. So it really isn't necessary. And what it does expose is huge backwards compatibility problems, which is one of the inspirations for making this thing, so that you'd never have to worry about that again. We decided against that. On the other hand, we might be willing to create, or with your help, create a new instruction language that we support at the same time as x86. Killing x86 altogether and replacing it with another instruction language, it's a cool idea. It's a cool project. It's just not something that customers seem to want to do, because they want those cheap-ass off-the-shelf x86 firmware parts, you know? So we tend to have dual or just x86, but in kind of our mindset. But if you guys have questions or ideas about what you'd like to see in a native set, put something together, put reasons why it'd be really cool, and we'd love to see them. Yeah?
How did you write your code block assembly? Is it in the
Okay, so his question is, how do we write the code morphing software? Is it in our target assembly language, or did we write it with GCC? The answer is, it's about 30% larger than Quake, except it's much manlier. It's got tons of Perl scripts, which generate tons of code. We do use a GCC backend. We do also use assembly. We use assembly for some of the really careful stuff, like servicing interrupts. We use assembly for some of those out-of-line things. In fact, we use it for, I think, all of them except for one, just because we want those to be as fast as possible, seeing as how they're already kind of, you know, out of line. We use GCC for as much as we can, because that way, when we come out with a new architecture, like, for instance, our entire, I think almost our entire interpreter is in C, which is what Linus wrote, by the way. And that's helped us a lot on our next generation architectures, because we're able to just recompile the interpreter and it works. And that's cool. It's a portable CPU. Yeah. So his question is, will there be a Transmeta-based Macintosh box? I don't know. I think someone at Transmeta has had a chat with Apple or something. I'm not in the loop on that. But I don't think we are seriously hardcore. I mean, we're trying to focus on one thing at a time right now, is a short answer. Getting x86 right is a huge problem. And it's not just the engineering problem. It's the marketing problem. It's the productization problem. It's the, you know, lots of big issues. So we're still rather focused on that. But and like I said, we have experimented with creating other personalities. I think the G4 is a wonderful chip, and I don't see any reason to do a CUSA version of it right now. Another big problem with doing a G4 type thing is that we are little endian, and boy, does that make your translation suck wind. And we would have to basically do a little sort of big endian mode bit in there, which just adds a lot of logic to our part. Now maybe someday we'll be big enough that we can, you know, focus an entire department on just the big endian guys and make a separate big endian part. But boys are a lot of work in that, and I don't know. It sounds kind of unlikely. But there are, actually, if you think about it, there are some other interesting little endian processors out there which we could do a much better job with. So, yeah, you haven't asked a question yet.
What's the sort of resource overhead that CMS is eating in the background?
So his question is, what's the resource overhead that CMS is eating in the background? And the main thing it's eating is iCache space. It eats some of your memory. So if you have if the guy who made the notebook computer put 64 meg of memory in there, physical memory, and allocated 8 meg or 16 meg to CMS, then when he ships it to you, it'll appear to be a 48 meg machine. We eat a piece of memory, and it causes a little iCache pressure if it's translating too often or if it's interpreting too often. But with Linux apps, that doesn't happen. Linux is really well behaved. It gets stuff translated quickly. There's very little churn. It is a translation cache, so things do get kicked out of the cache if you thrash it too hard. So if you have some monstrous thing you're running with lots and lots of code, and it's all very, very active code. For instance, we saw some soft modem drivers which implemented huge, huge state machines in generated C++, which after we talked to the driver authors, they sort of went, you know, blushed and said, oh, that was kind of retarded. But basically, giant footprints which are active very quickly and need to be active right away. In the soft modem case, it needed to be super fast right as it was connecting, right? That sort of thing. You've got to generate those right tones quickly enough. And so it would have been better if they had made a tone generator engine. Like, I mean, any game developer, this would be kind of a big duh. You know, okay, make an engine, you reuse the engine, don't waste time doing all this different thing. They made this giant templated monster, right? And so that was an example of where the resourcey thing kicks in. But usually, I mean, I haven't seen anything where you can look at CMS and saying, oh man, that's taking too much time on any major modern app.
But otherwise, it's several megabytes of disk or ROM?
No, just regular RAM. So We've got two RAM buses coming off the chip. We've got a bus for DDR RAM, which is much faster. We've got a bus for regular SDRAM. And some of the manufacturers want to use all SDRAM because they're cheap. Some of them want to use DDR just for CMS because then if you do have eye cache pressure, it still executes very fast. It pulls it in very quickly. So we dedicate a different. If you want, you can dedicate a separate memory bus just to the CMS code and data, and it is a faster bus. And you don't have to, but or you can use DDR for the whole thing. And split it up, or SD, or some combo. You can split up the RAM however you want on each bus. But, yeah. Does that answer your question? Yeah. Yeah. Okay. All right. Okay, thanks. So we have to wrap it up. One more question, and then we'll take off. You tend not to shut down banks of RAM because if it's not refreshed, you lose the bits in it.
If you can say to your kernel, okay, go into a lower RAM mode so that you can operate in a standby state.
So RAM, by the way, is very cheap. It was a surprise to me, but RAM doesn't burn much power at all, even if you're refreshing it. Nothing compared to like a CPU or a video chipset. So if you're in suspended RAM mode where you're not actually executing anything, but your entire state is in RAM, very cheap. So thanks very much for coming. And if you guys want to talk about resumes or working at Transmeta, chance to debug or do native code, just come grab me.